Interlude. Floss.
And it looks like the rain has truly broken the spirit of the face-eater moths. What a dramatic end! A simple climate change spell has reversed the entire battle and indeed saved the city of Liskor. A stunningly intelligent move by that young mage, wouldn't you say, Noas?
Indeed, Sorels, although I would point out that it was destined to rain sooner or later, given Liskor's unique climate. However, actively encouraging the climate change was a smart move. I can see our fantastic soldiers from Palace finishing the last of the moths off now. No doubt this will be a hotly debated topic in the days to follow.
Without a doubt, this dungeon is unlike any I've seen before, and it's... I'm told that it's being considered a gold rank dungeon, and that will play a major role in the politics of the Drake cities, and perhaps the human ones. Adventurers will be coming to claim the dungeon's riches, but the strategic danger of the dungeon cannot be underestimated. I wonder if Liskor is prepared to handle the influx of both monsters and adventurers into the city.
They've certainly incorporated a few adventuring teams well. The Half-Seekers, Griffin Hunt, and the Horns of Hammerod, all names to watch. Now, let's go back to the battle. I wonder if we can find someone to talk to. Ah, it's the innkeeper! Hello, miss, how are you?
Aaron gave the two drakes a bright smile and then slammed the door in their faces. The two chattering commentators went silent. The crowd from Palace burst out into complaints. They tried to open the door again, but it only revealed a brick wall. The magical connection had been severed, at least for the moment. And with it, the mage in Palace apparently decided his work was done, too. The image of the Drake City disappeared, and the connection broke. Across the world, people looked up from their scrying orbs, scrying hand mirrors, enchanted magical pools of water, and, in one case, a shield enchanted with far-seeing and clairvoyance. Some pondered what had occurred, while others laughed and went about their lives, thinking of Liskor's battles as a pleasant diversion, a distraction. Magnolia Reinhardt did not think of it that way. She was immediately in conference with Ressa and a few ladies and lords whom she trusted. Lord Tyrion did not speculate, but rather adjusted his plans slightly. The walled cities began arguing with each other, and Palace found itself defending its decisions as all five other walled cities blasted the Palacian army's lack of support for Liskor. So it was in Israel. However, in other places, other continents, the reactions of those who had seen Liskor's struggle were different. The King of Destruction put down the marble-sized scrying orb at last and stretched. Then he began pacing around excitedly.
What a battle! Tremendous! Those are the kind of monsters that live in Israel, are they? And they emerged from a dungeon! I had heard of legendary dungeons filled with monsters, but to think they could grow to such size! What treasures must they be guarding? What ancient nation constructed such a dungeon, I wonder? And to what end? Gozzi, you never spoke of the scope of Liskor's dungeon!
He turned, his eyes shining with excitement, to stare at the woman sitting across from him. Gozzi looked up. Two of her four smaller eyes focused on Floss, her king, while the other two moved around restlessly in their sockets. She opened her mouth and smiled at him with sharp teeth.
I did not know the extent of the dungeon, my king. To my knowledge, Liskor's dungeon was only a two-level crypt filled with undead. The true extent of the dungeon evaded my sight. Although I did note the Antinium Hive had dug extensively underneath the city, their activity may well have concealed the dungeon from my gaze.
I see. Perhaps they were aware of the dungeon before now. Oh, but what a city! The Antinium, the fabled scourge of Rear and Israel, living in peace with drakes and gnolls. I saw those, what did you call them? Soldiers? They were painted for battle.
Yes, that is new.
Intriguing.
Floss grinned. His face was not as alien as Gazi's, where the half-gazer's skin was orange-brown and her face was loosely based on a human's. Floss was entirely human. Gazi had no nose, four smaller eyes and one large central eye, and hair tied back into a braided ponytail. Floss had red-gold hair, a strong nose and features worthy of a statue. He was a king. Not just any king, the king of destruction. A man who had once ruled over almost all of Chandrar and been poised to invade the other continents of the world. Floss's name had been known by every nation under the sun until he had suddenly and unexpectedly given up his dreams of world domination. He had entered into what many called his slumber, and his kingdom had fallen to pieces. Most of his vassals had left him, and his lands had been reclaimed by his enemies and other nations. He had slumbered for over a decade until two humans from Earth had appeared in his throne room. And then the King of Destruction had woken up. He had called his vassals back to him, reclaimed his throne, and found the spark of ambition to once again rule. He had called his most trusted followers to him, his seven, a group of legends that had helped him conquer years ago. Only three had responded. Of the seven, three were dead. Quaravia and Totenval had been slain before Floss had entered his slumber. Another, Dravish, had been killed by the Emperor of Sands. His head had been sent to Floss, and the King of Destruction had vowed to slay the Emperor of Sands himself. And one more, Amaris, had not responded, though she was known to live in Wistrum, the home of mages. Four of the seven were absent, but three had come. Tecatris, Lord of the Skies, the birdman who led his tribe of Garuda against the Emperor of Sands at this very moment, the fastest being on Chandrar, and perhaps the world. Mars, the Illusionist, a mighty vanguard and a champion of Floss's armies, practically undefeatable in battle, Mars took the appearance of a beautiful woman with magical artifacts while concealing her true nature. And finally, Gazi Pathseeker, known as Gazi the Omniscient, a named adventurer and scout, feared for her ability to spot any threat, deception, or spell from miles away. She had returned from Lascaur blinded, her central eye damaged by an encounter with a certain innkeeper. She sat before Floss now in front of the campfire. It was night. In fact, it was so late into the night that it was closer to dawn than not. Lascaur was far removed from Chandrar, and thus evening in Lascaur was deep night for Floss. His excitement had forbade sleeping, however, and as the king walked around his fire, more people sat up. "My king, it's late. Wouldn't it be better to rest now? We have a long day in front of us, and it will be dawn in a few hours. Why not lie down until then? My bed is open." A sultry voice spoke from the side. Floss glanced over and looked at a beautiful woman lying on the ground. She was half naked underneath the stars, and her skin was dusky and flawless. She looked like some vision of the sands, unreal under the moonlight and the surrounding arid desert. To look at her was to be entranced, and one young man sitting around the fire gulped and looked away. Floss just stared blankly. Gazi rolled two of her eyes and tossed a bit of sand. The image of the beautiful woman flickered just a hair as the sand struck her in the face. For a fraction of a second, a shorter, less enthralling woman could be seen wiping sand from her face. Then the illusion returned. Mars glared at Ghazi. The half-gazer only smirked.
Bad illusion. You need a new artifact.
Mars, the illusionist, narrowed her eyes. She drew the simple blanket more firmly around her body.
Maybe I'll get one tomorrow. What about you, Ghazi? Going to get a new eye?
There was an intake of breath from the two other people sitting around the fire. Ghazi just grinned, not affected by the jest. She pointed to her closed central eye.
Perhaps one made of gold. It would do me no worse than my current eye, and look better. Would you like to see what my eye looks like now? It has yet to recover.
Ugh, pass.
Mars shuddered and looked away. She gestured alluringly to Floss. He was still staring at the scrying orb, as if hoping it would show the score once more.
Well, my king?
What? I suppose you're right, Mars. Why not let us sleep for a moment? The bazaar awaits, after all, although I shall hardly sleep a wink after such excitement.
He sighed, but made to lie down. Mars scooted her bedroll closer, and Ghazi sat up as if to do the same. Floss ignored both and lay down on the ground. He closed his eyes and began snoring within minutes. Mars and Ghazi stared at him. They turned around and looked at the other two companions around their fire. Trey and Therese, the twins from Earth, looked at them. They hurriedly turned.
Time to go to sleep. Night.
They rolled into their bedrolls, which provided them sanctuary from the cold night air. Mars and Ghazi eyed each other and then went to sleep as well. This was Chandrar, and this was the King of Destruction's camp. He was far from his kingdom of Rhyme at the moment, having traveled for 3 days at speed. He was headed to the Gyros Bazaar. Trey still wasn't sure why. Morning came too quick and too early. Trey woke up as someone kicked him in the ribs. Up! He shot out of bed. The kick hadn't been hard, but the second one would be worse. The young man from England rolled out of bed and looked around blearily. It was still dark, but the smiling half-gazer didn't seem to care. Ghazi nodded to the campfire where a pot was already simmering. Trey could smell the mild aroma of Yelats cooking with grain. It was a slightly spicy, filling soup, and his stomach rumbled at the thought of breakfast. But breakfast came after pain. Trey got up, grabbing the staff at his side, and looked at Ghazi.
Training.
Training.
She grinned at him. Trey groaned in mild resignation. This was always how his day started. At the break of dawn, Ghazi woke him up. He raised his staff as she led him to a spot just away from the fire.
Now, cast.
Flush! Sand arrow!
The staff that Trey held was expensive, and the orb held in place at the top flashed with blinding light as an arrow of sand shot across the desert. It flew past a group of three training with swords. Floss, Mars, and Therese looked up as Ghazi nodded.
More arrows. Hit that rock. There.
She pointed to a hand-sized rock 20 paces away. Trey squinted to see it and aimed.
Sand arrows!
More arrows flew and hit the ground right around the rock. It was a good shot. Ghazi looked mildly disappointed. She thumped Trey with the flat of her huge greatsword.
Aim better.
Sweating already, Trey did. He kept shooting arrows of sand until Ghazi made him switch to casting Flash and the other few spells he knew. Trey was a mage. His sister Therese was a warrior, aspiring to become a blade master. Or perhaps aspiring wasn't the right word. They were the personal servants to Floss. Or companions? Vassals? It was hard to tell. Trey and Therese followed the King of Destruction around. They were hardly as useful as the rest of his servants, like Orthanon, his steward, or the other vassals, like the stern Veneth or his wife, Marisar.
But they had knowledge from another world, and Floss claimed it was they who had given him the inspiration to wake from his slumber. So, for that reason, they were indispensable, and Floss's vassals had taken it upon themselves to train Trey and Therese to be worthy of accompanying the King of Destruction. There were few mages in the Kingdom of Rhyme, Floss's nation, so Ghazi was training Trey in the use of magic. He hated and enjoyed it. Trey wiped sweat from his face in the brief moment Ghazi allowed him to rest. He hated Ghazi's strict requirements regarding his aim, the flow of mana in his body, and the speed at which he cast spells. Too slow or off target, and she'd hit him with her blade. But he loved magic.
Good. You hit the target 6 times out of 8.
Ghazi didn't have to turn her head to count Trey's strikes on the tiny rock they'd been using as a target. Her 4 smaller eyes could all move independently, and they were powerful enough to see through walls, and indeed, her head. Trey wondered what her large eye was capable of. He also wondered who would have dared to blind Ghazi. She was fearsome, unreadable, and very deadly. She was also his only friend, if they could call themselves that. Ghazi hung around Trey more often than anyone else. She was a loner, but she had formed a bond with Trey after he had objected to a practice the King of Destruction and his nation allowed, keeping slaves. He hadn't realized it, but the entire continent of Chandrar kept slaves or sold prisoners of war and criminals to the slave traders of Rishal in exchange for coin. Chandrar was the biggest exporter of slaves in the world, and Floss had sold off the first army he had crushed to feed his impoverished kingdom. Trey understood the reasoning, but he couldn't accept it. He had argued futilely against Floss's decision, and the ensuing fight had driven a rift between both him and Floss, and between Trey and his sister. There was still a gap, months later. Trey stared at Therese as she trained with Floss and Mars. The other two warriors took it easy on her, despite Therese's skill with her sword. She had improved in leaps and bounds and was already a level 18 warrior, soon to become a swordswoman according to Orthanon, her teacher. Trey didn't know how he felt about his sister becoming a warrior. He didn't know how he felt about being a mage, to be honest. It still felt like he could pinch himself and wake up from the dream he was in. The King of Destruction? Magic? Levels? He was in a dream. Smack! Trey staggered as Ghazi hit him with the flat of her blade.
Ow!
Enough rest. Give me 5 casts of Sand Veil in quick succession. Change directions each time.
Okay, maybe he wasn't dreaming. Trey rubbed the back of his neck and did as she instructed. Training with Ghazi was hard. Speaking to Ghazi was hard sometimes. But she was a friend. She understood how he felt about slavery. She had been a slave once.
Breakfast!
Floss roared the words at last, and Trey sagged in relief. He trudged back to the campfire, already wrung out by casting so many spells so early. He'd feel better after an hour and some rest. His internal reservoirs of mana would refill. It was important to keep pushing himself, though. According to Ghazi, most mages were lazy and didn't use all the power their bodies were capable of. She intended to make Trey a mage beyond all others. He feared she might succeed.
What have we here? Yelats, Crane! Ah, what a familiar meal! It feels as if we've had it for the last 4 days in a row!
The King of Destruction laughed in good humor as he peered into the cooking pot. He was a huge man, muscle without fat, and he always seemed to be bursting with energy. He was also apparently over 40 years old. He looked more in the prime of his life than Trey did. Floss took a seat on the arid ground and looked around.
Has the rest of the camp had breakfast, Ghazi?
They are eating now, my lord. We'll be on our way within 30 minutes. We should reach the bazaar just after morning.
Good. I haven't been to Jiros's bazaar in over 2 decades. I hope everything has changed.
Floss rubbed his hands together.
Trey, sitting exhausted next to his twin sister, looked up.
Your Majesty?
Yes, Trey?
The king looked up, pleased to be asked a question. He had striven to bridge the gap caused over the winter, and Trey's willingness to ask him questions was a first step in mending their strained relationship. Trey hesitated.
Are you, is it truly all right for you to leave your kingdom for so long, Your Majesty? Especially right now? You don't have much of an escort.
Trey broke off, aware that he was in earshot of the other people sitting at campfires further away. They did not intrude on the king's personal campfire, but they still sat close enough to defend their ruler at a heartbeat's notice. Their escort was a mixture of warriors and mages, all of them elite. The band of stringfolk warrior mercenaries known as the Serpent Hunters and the small coven of mages known as Parasol Stroll had joined Floss's kingdom during the winter. Both groups of his former vassals were incredibly dangerous, and they had been selected to follow Floss wherever he went. Floss only smiled as he saw Trey looking at the robed men and women holding parasols over their heads and the silent men and women with stitch marks around their arms and legs who wore dark green armor.
My escort is more than enough to handle any brigands or monsters by themselves, Trey. We could handle a small army with Mars and Gauzy. Never fear that I'm undefended. Besides, we are traveling to Gyros, and the bazaar does not tolerate armies marching upon it. As for your second question, this is an important trip, firstly, and secondly, my kingdom is well attended in my absence.
But you just fought a war. Two wars.
Trey had been there. He had ridden with Floss as the King of Destruction had fought off the first armies that had come seeking his destruction. After his grand defeat of the Coalition army besieging his capital city at Rhyme, the King of Destruction had led his army north against two of the kingdoms that had caused him harm. The Kingdom of Germina, ruled by the Cuirass, and the Kingdom of Helios. Both nations had sent an army to trap Floss by slaughtering his people as they fled towards the city, and very nearly succeeded. In return, Floss had marched his armies into their kingdoms and destroyed both. The memory made Trey shiver, and Floss saw it. The King of Destruction smiled gently, not quite looking at Trey.
Orthanon is more suited to the job of managing the kingdom, Trey. He is quelling unrest in both nations and ensuring law and order. A steward can do such things, oft-times better than a king can. Besides which, my face would only spark more hatred in both nations at the moment.
That was certainly true. Trey remembered the sight of Floss's armies besieging the capital of Helios and fighting Germina's armies on the field. It had been a slaughter. With the defeat of the Coalition army, no other nation had been willing to come to the aid of either kingdom. And in a one-on-one battle against the King of Destruction, no small nation had a chance. It had been so quick. But before the winter had begun to set in, Floss's armies had marched north at speed. He had taken Orthanon, Mars, and Gauzy, leaving Marisar and Veneth to guard the kingdom in his absence. The conquest had taken less than 2 weeks. Helios had surrendered unconditionally, as the King of Destruction's armies had marched across their borders and crushed their army. The kingdom of Germina had not. Blood. It ran hot on the dry ground, quenching it. There was smoke in the air, though there was precious little to burn. The kingdom of Germina built its city out of mud, brick, and stone. Now Floss's army flooded through the streets, forcing frightened civilians back, pursuing the stragglers of the Cuirass's army. Trey rode ahead, following Floss, as the King of Destruction charged his mount towards the squat palace that was home to Germina's ruler, the Cuirass. It was an ancient building, grand because it was so old. It had been decorated with reliefs showing previous rulers over thousands of years. Floss rode into the building, his armor bloodied. Gazi followed, a swift shadow by her king's side.
Trey, come on!
Therese's eyes were blazing. She had fought in the last battle, though she had mainly been protected as she rode with the king's vanguard. Trey had stayed with the mages and thus not had to fight. He felt sick. The battle had been a one-sided slaughter. The King of Destruction had rode through the lightly armored ranks of Jermina's army, cutting the soldiers down by the thousands with his army. The twins pursued Floss and his personal vanguard. Trey could hear shouting behind them as the rest of the army spread out to seize the city. Orthanon was overseeing the surrender, and Mars was fighting the last of Jermina's forces that had refused to surrender. It felt wrong. Too easy, almost. It was hard to call war unfair, but after seeing Mars fight, after seeing how helpless Jermina's army was against the high-level vassals Floss commanded, Trey thought Mars could have destroyed Jermina's army by herself if she had enough time. She'd slain the Quinfer, the Jermina army's champion, in a duel that had lasted only a minute. Then she'd charged into the ranks of the army, ignoring the soldiers as they tried to batter her with their weapons. Unfair, but the cuirass had sent a mage to kill Floss. She had slaughtered the civilians that Floss had rallied to fight the army that had ambushed him. Floss had given the cuirass one chance to surrender. She had refused, sending his messenger back without the hand that had delivered the message. Now Floss rode into her throne room, Trey and Therese following just in time to see the cuirass rise from her throne. She was an old woman, older than Floss. For all that, she had an imposing presence, an aura of authority. It was powerful and made Trey halt. But if she was a candle, Floss was the sun itself. He dismounted from his horse as Gazi slew two of the soldiers who rushed towards him. The King of Destruction strode towards the cuirass, his bloody blade in hand. The cuirass didn't flinch. She raised a hand as Floss approached her.
Wretched King of Destruction, I would speak with you.
She never got a chance to finish. Floss strode up the dais and beheaded her. It was so quick that Trey was left gaping. Floss turned as the throne room erupted into screams. The cuirass's court threw themselves at the soldiers following Floss or fell to their knees. Floss raised his sword and bellowed.
The cuirass is dead! Throw down your arms or join her! Her crimes are not Jermina's! Join her, loyal citizens, or surrender!
His words had provoked a bloodbath in the throne room, but the streets went quiet. Soldiers and citizens of Jermina had fallen to their knees, weeping, and Floss's banner had flown over the city. Trey remained in the throne room, just staring. The cuirass's head had been placed under a shroud, but her headless corpse sat against her throne where it had collapsed. He thought she was still staring at Floss, staring at him.
Trey?
Trey jerked and realized he'd been lost, staring into the fire. Therese was looking at him. He knew his feelings were written on his face and turned away. It didn't help. Therese had been born only moments before he had, and the twins shared the closest thing to a psychic connection.
Hey. It's over.
Hesitantly, Therese hugged Trey. He let her do it, although the contact was awkward. Everything was so much harder now. He hadn't forgotten their fight, and she hadn't either, but she was comforting. The King of Destruction had slain the cuirass. Trey didn't understand Chandrarian politics, but he understood that it was a massive event that had scared and outraged the other kingdoms. However, they were loath to march against Floss and risk the same. So, they had secured their borders and threatened war should Floss so much as sneeze in their direction. The King of Destruction had been content to simply claim the lands of Helios and Jermina for now, and thus, no further wars had taken place yet. At least Helios's ruler was still alive.
Queen Calliope and her son, Prince Sayal, were captives in their own castle. Their deaths would have sparked a bloody uprising throughout their nation. Their lives prevented the same. Helios's army had laid down their arms almost to a man rather than keep fighting. A good thing, too. Floss had made it clear that he would behead both royals in an instant had they attempted to stir an insurrection. The image of Floss with bloody sword in hand was at odds with the man peering into the cooking pot and asking Gazi what seasoning she'd used. When he was not at war or enraged, Floss was full of life and energy, hard to anger, and impossibly fascinated with the most minute details of his citizens' lives. He seemed bigger and drew the attention in any room he entered. Mars had once joked that Floss could pass wind and still appear more kingly than half the kings on the continent. Trey believed her. Floss was one of the highest-leveled kings in the world. Perhaps the highest. His true level was unknown, a closely guarded secret. But his skills were incredibly powerful. They were all geared to war, making his kingdom prosperous in times of strife and impoverished at all other times. Hence their meal. Floss waved away a hovering stitch woman who inquired whether he'd like a meat breakfast or lizard's eggs or any of the other luxuries his people would be only too happy to provide him. He'd been asked the question every morning, and his answer was always the same.
I like simple food. I will be fine, Zaretha. Thank you for your concern.
The stitch woman withdrew. Trey, who sometimes thought his purpose in life was to ask the obvious questions to amuse Floss, raised his voice.
What's wrong with your breakfast, sire?
It seemed that people really objected to Floss eating the stringy, spicy vegetables called yellats. They were a staple of the Chandrarian diet, and tasted a bit like sweet potatoes if you made them spicy. Trey quite liked them. Floss exhaled slowly as he peered into the simmering cook pot. He took out a bowl, a wood and silver carved piece that Trey was sure was not standard for camping, and filled it with a bit to taste. He replied as he gently smacked his lips together, savoring the hot stew.
Yellats are considered a poor man's food, Trey. They are filling and easy to grow on this continent, more so than any other plant, in fact. This poor soil and the heat will kill potatoes in a drought, but yellats can survive extended dry spells. They are ideal, in my opinion, and I have grown up enjoying them. But to other nations, they are a symbol of poverty. Other monarchs would starve themselves before eating a meal such as this.
Floss shrugged, not at all concerned by this fact. He began pouring the hot soup into bowls and passing them around the fire. The King of Destruction delighted in such things, apparently. To him, activities like serving others or cooking were a luxury to be enjoyed when he was traveling abroad. In his palace and with his subjects, Floss was waited on hand and foot.
Come, let us eat and be off quickly. I wish to be at Giro soon.
He began to eat his food rapidly, and Trey quickly blew on his food and did the same. Life moved at Floss's pace, which was to say, fast. Within 20 minutes, they'd struck camp. The string folk loaded their bedrolls and supplies onto the pack horses and camels. Trey had been surprised that Chandrar had as many horses as camels. His image of the Middle East was limited at best. He was just as glad to mount the placid mare that Floss had picked out for him. He knew the camels were tetchy, even with experienced riders or animal handlers. He'd seen one spit right in the packmaster's face one time.
To Giros!
Floss shouted in good spirits, and his warriors cheered and set off. The king rode up and down the line of warriors and attendants, talking with them briefly, sometimes clapping a hand on a shoulder. His presence seemed to inspire, regardless of whether he spoke for a few minutes or just a second. Trey watched the King of Destruction leave his subjects with glowing smiles.
He is beloved. It isn't just his skills. A king who truly cares for each of his subjects is a rare sight in any land.
Gazi rode next to Trey, at ease on her stallion. He glanced at her. The half-gazer wore her brown scale armor like always. Her great sword she carried around sheathed on her hip, but only when she rode. It was actually too long to carry that way when she was walking on the ground. So Gazi kept it on her back. When Trey asked if it was hard to draw the sword, Gazi had just laughed and told him that anyone trying to catch her off guard would have to be very fast indeed. Now the half-gazer stared at her king with one eye, her other three scanning the desert landscape for danger. It wasn't all desert, of course. There were places with a lot of greenery and life, but the lands close to Rhyme had big, arid spots due to the lack of water. Water was a resource prized as much as gold in Chandrar, although gold was important too, which was why their trip to the Gyros Bazaar intrigued Trey so.
So, this bazaar, why are we going again?
Gazi half turned in her saddle, although all of her eyes remained focused in other directions. Trey tried not to shudder as the half-gazer smiled at him. It was her fake, small smile she always wore.
Simple, Trey. The Gyros Bazaar is an annual gathering of merchants and other sellers of goods. It has more treasures to be bought and sold than most nations will ever possess. It is an important place to visit, should you desire valuable artifacts.
Right. So, why does the King of Destruction want something from there? And if he wants something, why not take it?
His Majesty is not a thief.
Gazi looked reprovingly at Trey. She turned and nodded to a speck in the distance.
Besides which, if my lord wanted to seize the treasures of the bazaar, he would have to send a very large army to take it. As it stands, we who have come with him are a capable escort of defending him, but little more.
You're joking! Aren't you a named adventurer? And is it Mars?
Trey looked at Mars riding ahead of them, making ribald jokes with a mage carrying a parasol. Gazi nodded.
Mars is formidable, but the merchants have many guards and artifacts to defend themselves with. She is only one person in the end. As for myself, I would not arouse the wrath of the entire bazaar at any cost. The sellers and buyers unite in the face of threat, and there are most likely a number of individuals there that could best me.
Really?
A nod. Gazi gestured to her closed middle eye. Trey had never seen it open, but he had seen the pus and liquid that had trickled from it in the first few days, when Gazi had returned to the kingdom. He wondered if it could heal. Floss had talked about finding a healing potion strong enough to regrow Gazi's eye.
Without my main eye, I would be considered a high gold rank adventurer, not named. My lord as well.
Floss? But he's...
Strong, but not that strong, Trey.
Floss had overheard their conversation. He rode back, laughing as he gestured to the sword at his hip.
I am strong, Trey, and an experienced warrior. I could best a gold rank adventurer with the strength of my arm alone. But that does not make me a named adventurer. To become a famous hero known across the world, I would have to be truly outstanding in some way. Gazi obtained a title, thanks to her eye. She is virtually impossible to ambush with it, and she can cast spells with it. Her armor and blade is also of the highest quality.
But you're the King of Destruction.
Floss laughed again.
What is a king without an army, Trey? The answer, he is still a king, but again, without an army, and this king lacks both armor and sword. Had I my old arms, I might have been a named adventurer indeed, but I have neither armor nor sword, nor any of my enchanted rings or other equipment. That is one of the reasons I ride to Gyros, to find a sword capable of surviving more than a few blows in my hand.
He gestured at the steel sword at his waist. Floss did have a habit of wrecking the swords he was given. His remarks made Mars turn her horse backwards, frowning.
What? My king, what happened to your old blade?
I gave it away.
Floss smiled as Mars gaped at him.
That was a national treasure.
I know, but I had no need of it, and so I gave it to a soldier when I went into my slumber. I wonder where it is.
But your sword? What about your armor? Your helmet? Your lance?
Those two. I gave each piece away.
Your rings? The Ring of Health, the artifact that you took from the treasury of Armil.
And that, all gone. I regret it in hindsight.
Floss laughed hugely as Mars spluttered. He waved a hand as if brushing away all his lost treasures.
Mars, they serve no purpose in my grief. Besides, it is more entertaining to rebuild my armory this way. I hated my old armor anyways. It was enchanted with a featherweight spell, and I hated having to strap it down or have it bounce about every time I moved. I'm in mind for some heavier armor. Enchanted, of course, but with a different focus.
They rode on as Floss began talking animatedly about armor with Mars, arguing for certain enchantments, vouching for armor enchanted with magical shields, disputing the notion that swords enchanted with sharpness were better than swords enchanted with weight, and so on. Trey listened with half an ear. It sounded like a discussion between people playing a tabletop game or a video game, but it was all real, and those discussing it were in deadly earnest. He watched as a collection of tents came into view. The Gyros Bazaar was based around an oasis, and it was a sprawling, noisy affair this early in the morning. It was also magical. Trey could see shopkeepers and traders displaying artifacts, showing them off by conjuring water out of the air or letting customers test their products. But he also saw signs of the visitors' wealth. There were summoned servants flying through the air, genii who appeared as sometimes humanoid, sometimes outlandish shapes that were half corporeal, embodying the element of air or fire or some other aspect. And beyond them, Trey saw someone sitting on an elephant, arguing with a man on a camel on where he could rest his mount. He saw a magic carpet flying through the air and a screaming man drop. The entire caravan groaned, and Floss grimaced as Trey looked away.
Oh, that's why no one rides those things. Looks like the bazaar is just waking up.
You call that just waking up?
Trey stared as a mage arguing with a merchant at a stall turned and vanished in a puff of smoke. The Gyros Bazaar was filled with amazing people, and surprisingly, very few of them looked inclined to cause trouble. Indeed, if there was thievery, it was only going on in an economic sense. Pickpockets and thieves were in grave danger in the bazaar. Trey saw a man turn as someone grabbed a pouch at his belt.
Stop! Thief!
The cloaked figure ran with incredible speed through the crowd. He got 15 paces before a man in a skull cap with a huge chest thick with hair stabbed him in the chest. The thief ran backwards, screaming, and was enveloped in flame, shot with two arrows, and struck by a being made out of lightning. His corpse was quickly tossed out of the bazaar.
Don't cause trouble.
Floss smiled as he approached the bazaar. Trey eyed him with trepidation, because the King of Destruction was nothing but trouble. However, Floss touched an amulet on his chest, and Gazi and Mars both twisted rings, and they turned into different people as they approached the bazaar. Floss grinned down at Trey through a face 10 years younger, with dark skin and black hair.
Surprised? I wouldn't walk into the bazaar with my face, Trey. Believe it or not, I can be cautious.
Won't the mages be able to tell you're under an illusion?
Oh, most definitely. But anonymity is prized at the bazaar. Many of those visiting are wearing a disguise of their own.
Floss flicked his fingers dismissively. He eyed Ghazi. The half-gazer had turned into a woman with starry eyes and long, flowing locks of blue hair.
Ghazi, that illusion is ridiculous.
Blame Mars. She lent me the rings.
They're for my use, not yours.
Mars, a redhead dressed in impractically revealing armor, shot back. She gave Floss a charming smile.
Shall we, Your Majesty?
Indeed. Let's set up camp a ways away from the bazaar. Hasil, Philippe!
The leader of the serpent hunters and the mage who spoke for Parasol Stroll rode towards him. Floss nodded to the bazaar.
Don't let more than 8 of your people enter the bazaar at once. Keep the rest at camp. I will be going into the bazaar for the day.
Yes, Your Majesty.
Hasil, the dark-skinned stitch man, bowed, his hand on his poisoned scimitar. Philippe, the human mage with a sharp goatee, nodded.
Do you require an escort, Your Majesty?
No, Mars and Ghazi will be enough. Trey and Therese will follow me, naturally. I will browse quietly. Weapons stalls, I think, although Ghazi will look for a healing potion for her eye.
We'll split up.
How much coin do you have, Ghazi? The half-gazer reached for her belt pouch.
Enough. I have several thousand gold pieces and enough to barter with. My lord?
I have 10,000 gold pieces in my bag of holding.
Therese choked as she stared at the small bag at Floss's side. This one wasn't the typical leather pouch that inconspicuously hung at Ghazi's waist. It was a black and ruby affair taken from the cuirass's treasury, as had the contents of the bag, Trey suspected.
That's not much to buy with, sire.
Mars looked concerned at the small amount that Floss had brought. The King of Destruction smiled.
I have a number of jewels I found as well, but I intend to spend lightly, Mars. Most of the gold must go to my kingdom and arming my soldiers. I simply wish for a decent quality sword. You recall I broke the last one?
Wasn't it enchanted?
Poorly. Spells can break just as easily as steel if you swing hard enough, Therese. We might see about getting you a blade as well. Mars, how much gold do you have?
More than you. I fought as a mercenary for 2 decades, my king. I could buy you armor as well.
A few artifacts might not go amiss. A shame djinn are so difficult to manage, or I'd seriously consider a flying army of them. Remember the Kingdom of Olais? Oh, fantastic at harassing the enemy. But now that I think of it, a flying carpet.
They began heading into the bazaar. Floss had elected to dismount, so they all walked on foot, joining the crowds of people walking past the open tents that had been set up. Some were magical, so the tents were larger on the inside than the outside. Trey gaped at the objects on display. There were magic scrolls, floating orbs, and then things that didn't look so magical. Like rich saffron being sold by the pound, sheaves of high-quality paper, food, and ice being offered by some food merchants. It was a feast for the eyes, ears, and nose. Almost overwhelming, in fact. Trey looked at Ghazi. She was following Floss as he looked around animatedly, talking loudly to Mars and Therese.
Are you going to shop by yourself?
Ghazi turned. She had no eyebrows to raise, but Trey saw her skin move in the same way.
Would you like to come with me?
I wouldn't mind.
Ghazi smiled. It wasn't that Trey wouldn't mind following the King of Destruction. It was just that he liked Ghazi's company.
Very well. My king...
She broke off as their group of 5 passed by a crowd. The man who had fallen off the carpet had survived his fall, but had broken both his legs in multiple places. He was screaming for help as traders clustered around him, offering him a number of objects.
Sans, my legs! My legs are healing potions, please!
Can I interest you in a bone regrowth potion, sir? The finest to be had for miles.
Pain-numbing tonic? Just a whiff and you'll be free of pain.
Would you like me to retrieve your carpet, sir? My genie can find it for a nominal fee.
The poor man reached for his money pouch as Floss passed by. The King of Destruction turned his head as he looked around.
Blacksmithing. I'm sure there's an entire row of tents devoted to weapons. Ah, well, we'll find our way there eventually. Gabrielle, are you going?
The half-gazer bowed slightly.
I will return within the hour, sire. May I take Trey with me?
Oh, but I had hopes to enjoy... if you wish...
Floss frowned slightly, looking almost hurt that Trey wouldn't follow him around. It would be him asking Trey exactly what he found familiar from his world and his opinion on everything. Trey knew. Therese was giving Trey a look that told him to stay and join in her suffering. Trey gave her a guilty grin.
I'm sorry you met... sire.
Far be it from me to distract you. Besides which, you might keep Gauzy occupied. Don't start a fight if someone insults my name, Gauzy, and keep Trey safe.
Floss sternly instructed Gauzy before turning and staring at a stall filled with scrying orbs and mirrors and so on.
Now here's a shop that catches my interest. I could have watched that battle at Liscor far more easily, and without hurting my neck with one of these. Shopkeeper, how much is this orb?
He held up a yellow sphere that shone with inner light. The man who hurried up to him with a welcoming smile had a turban on his head and silk clothing.
Ah, good eye, sir. 8,000 gold pieces.
For an orb this small?
Floss looked dismayed. The man bowed his head slightly.
Ah, it's not just used for scrying, but records memory as well, hence the price. Did I hear you say you observed the most entertaining affair in Liscor?
We did. However, my scrying orb was only so big.
Floss indicated the marble-sized object. The shopkeeper tisked.
Oh, a true shame. For a distinguished person such as yourself, you should have one at least the size of a man's head. Allow me to walk you through my wares. Did you know more broadcasts are occurring?
No, truly?
Yes.
The shopkeeper smiled as he showed Floss a huge orb which a crowd of people were staring into. Trey and Gauzy paused to stare at another image flashing across the orb.
It seems Wistrom's ability to link the orbs of scrying is a service they are willing to offer to more than Drake cities. Look, this is a mock battle by the Titan himself in Baleros.
A tiny figure was standing on a podium in the sphere's image. As Trey watched, whoever was keeping the image steady shifted, and he saw a row of soldiers with wooden spears fending off a cavalry charge. The projection was being watched with fascination by the crowd.
One of the Titan students set it up. There are kings and lords and countless others watching this at the moment. I believe Wistrom intends to offer this service at a great price.
I see.
Floss narrowed his eyes as the Titan stood on a dais, shouting orders that were transmitted out to his army. Trey saw his hands clench for a second, and saw Mars and Gauzy shift and look at their king. It was Nir's Astoragon who slew Quiravia, the gambler of fates. Trey shivered as he saw Floss's gaze darken for a moment. But then the King of Destruction was talking animatedly with the shopkeeper.
So, any orb can be turned into a recording device for such a projection? Is such grand magic possible?
If Wistrom wills it. But I believe a mage must transmit the image. These humble orbs only convey the image that Wistrom sends. Speaking of which, may I interest you in this way?
Gauzy murmured and tugged Trey's arm. He followed her into a crowd, peering back over his shoulder, and for a second regretting not staying with Floss. Then he turned back to Gauzy. He had to focus on her back to avoid getting lost in the crowd.
Where are we going?
Healing potions.
Gazi raised her voice to be heard. She led Trey through the crowd. The young man looked around from stall to stall. So many things on display at once. He thought he saw the row of tents Floss had mentioned, where armor and blades were being sold. And were there actual blacksmiths making weapons at this moment? He heard a clang, looked to ask Gazi about it, and realized he'd lost her.
I'm telling you, this isn't a good blade. Show me a better one.
A few minutes later, Floss was arguing with a merchant over a blade. Therese and Mars found him pointing at a shimmering saber that sparked with lightning. The disguised king looked disgusted as he held the saber up. The merchant pursed her lips.
Oh, what is wrong with that blade? You picky humans. This one is enchanted to shock your enemies. Simply but tap your opponent and they won't be moving anytime soon.
She was a stitch woman. Floss shook his head.
It's fragile. The enchantment's no good, and the blade's, what, pure silver? An enchantment on that won't last.
Oh, and you're an expert on blades?
The merchant was either inexperienced or had misjudged Floss entirely. He smiled.
Give me a warhammer, Maven.
Mars plucked a warhammer off the racks and tossed it to Floss. He set the saber back down and raised the warhammer. The merchant raised her hands and screeched.
What are you doing?
Any good sword can take a blow like that. Any enchanted blade should be able to take an unenchanted maul strike, or the enchantment is no good.
Floss raised his voice. He'd attracted a crowd, which listened to him speak about blades. He raised the faulty saber, pointing to the silvery metal.
A blade is only as good as its blacksmith, regardless of the magic put on it. If you bought this blade for anything more than 400 gold coins, you lost your deal, Miss Merchant. This is a half-decent enchantment, but the blade will shatter far, far too quickly. I'd rather have an unenchanted blade of quality metal than an enchanted blade that will break after hitting a shield.
He tossed the saber back on the rack as the merchant went pale. Several people in the crowd nodded appreciatively, agreeing with Floss's assessment. The king smiled and turned to Mars and Therese, who'd just returned from shopping elsewhere.
Ah, any good shops?
Some decent swords among the trash. I'll show you.
Mars led Floss and Therese through the crowd, pointing out the good picks she'd spotted. Therese watched attentively. She had her own sword that Orthanon had given her, but the magical swords fascinated her. Floss just shook his head time after time, though. He stopped at a well-stocked tent and spoke to the merchant waiting on his customers.
Have you no enchanted swords worthy of a gold-rank adventurer or better?
Ah, sir, I have this new blade that is enchanted with petrification.
But the steel's poor!
Mars and Floss objected almost at the same time. Therese stared at the blade, unable to tell the difference. Floss looked dismayed.
I could pay to have a better enchantment put on the blade here, or have it done later. What about your unenchanted blades? Show me your best. Do you have any dwarven-made blades?
The sweating merchant hurried into the back, and his slaves came out with an assortment of blades. He was on trial, as the crowd that followed Floss had gathered again. The king was simply too loud and too amusing to ignore, and his opinions too solid. Floss inspected one blade and grunted.
Better, but this is still only adequate for an enchantment. Do you truly have no masterworks? Something made by a level 40 blacksmith or better?
Honored guest, these are dwarf-forged blades.
I have no doubt, but I'm talking about real dwarven craftsmanship, not just their mass-produced arms.
Floss turned away when he realized the merchant had no idea what he was talking about. He walked through the bazaar, talking to Mars and Therese.
Perhaps I thought too highly of Chiros's markets. Then again, truly masterwork blades would be rare. I wonder if it wouldn't be better to have a blade forged myself and enchanted here.
We can look among the blacksmiths, but I don't know their levels or the metals they work with, sire. I saw one tent claiming to work with pure mithril. A blade like that would hold an enchantment, but pure mithril? I suspect it's a trick. Mars made a face. Therese stared at the blade's floss had so dismissively discarded.
What did you mean, real dwarven craftsmanship, Flans? Do you mean all that's fake?
Not at all.
Floss grinned at Therese, enjoying his fake name. He pointed at another row of dwarf-quality blades on display.
Dwarven-made weapons vary in quality, but the dwarves are good blacksmiths, and their steel is pure. It's an indication of quality, but most of the blades are simply better than regular. You might as well turn to a blacksmith on your continent with a higher level for a good sword. However, I know there are better arms made in their mountain home, however seldom.
Really?
Really?
Both Mars and Therese stared at Floss in surprise. He nodded and bought a few kebabs for them to eat while he explained. Floss tore the hot meat off a skewer as he spoke.
Back when my kingdom first expanded, before I had met you, Mars, I decided to invest in my army. I had obtained a fortune from the kingdoms I had destroyed, and so I ordered a massive shipment of dwarven arms from Tyrandria. We sent a fortune to the dwarves in exchange for arms for over 1,000 soldiers, as well as personal armor and a blade for Gossi.
And they delivered?
No, that was the curious part of it. The dwarves failed to provide a tenth of the arms I paid for. They had overcommitted and suffered a disaster in their forges, or so I was given to understand. They were unable to repay me either, so they sent me a set of armor and blade for Gossi instead.
One blade and suit of armor?
The very one she wears, and if it seems a poor repayment, Mars, it was not. I don't know what blacksmith made the armor, but it was worth far more than I paid, than I could have paid at the time, I believe. You know Gossi's scale armor, Therese, and her blade? Neither one is enchanted.
What? Mars raised her voice, attracting attention. She lowered it and hissed at Floss.
It has to be. That armor's been through more wars than... I've had to replace my armor 3 times, and I buy the best quality armor money can afford.
Nevertheless, it was made by the truest of experts. I've never inquired as to the make of the armor, as I doubt any of my blacksmiths could hope to replicate it. It's a masterwork, Mars. In the mountains, there are some dwarves who truly know metal.
Incredible. And you hope to find a blade like that? Here? I think I would have noticed such a weapon.
Indeed, it would be a long shot, and I am more interested in that scrying orb in truth, what that merchant said about anyone broadcasting their image.
Floss looked back in the direction of the scrying orbs, then turned to Therese.
You said it's familiar to something from your world, Therese. What was it you mentioned?
Television.
Of course. You did tell me about it, but I had imagined something entirely different. And this is similar.
Therese hesitantly explained as Floss listened with growing interest. She didn't like the look in his eyes when she talked about news appearing all over the world. Therese cursed Trey and hoped he was having fun wherever he was. She was going to kick his butt for leaving her behind when she met up with him again. Now, while Ashifra Tanusin tossed her head and grabbed the hilt of her dagger, she was nearly out of patience with the man in front of her. She would have drawn her blade and stabbed the man twice if she could have gotten away with it, but doing so would scare away other customers, and she and her people needed this sale. So she kept her voice pleasant, though her every instinct railed against her acting like a common merchant.
It is simple, you oaf, you. Look, this is Nokarama steel, pure ingots, forged in the heat of my people's forges. May the dunes take me if I lie. It is not some metal you find lying about on the streets or melted out of cheap steel. It is magic and enchantable, and I am selling it to you.
She glared at the dark-skinned trader, who was blinking hard in obvious confusion. Though he looked accustomed to the sun, Nawal Ashifra was sure he was a city dweller, not a true son or daughter of the sands. If he was, he would not ask so many foolish questions. Her skin was far darker than his, and Nawal Ashifra had to shift her veil not to inhale it as she talked. She knew she was not what he had expected. There were few women in her clan who could swing a hammer, and she was the only blacksmith in her clan worthy of the class. That was the problem, sadly.
I don't understand. This metal's special? But it's an ingot. Why haven't you made it into a sword? It's useless as it is.
Nawal Ashifra turned red and gripped the hilt of her dagger. She didn't know what would come first, dagger or sharp words, but another young man pushed forwards. He had too wide a smile and was too unctuous as he bowed to the man in front of him. She wouldn't have minded it, save for the fact that he was her brother, Alif. He stepped in front of Nawal Ashifra as she glared at him.
Sir, please excuse my sister, ill-tempered though she is from standing out in the sun. She does speak a truth, however. The metal is yet to be smithed, but surely an outstanding buyer such as yourself can see the merits of buying the steel as it is. It is ready to be shaped into shield or sword or mace or arrowhead, and the metal is magic, as my unmarried and ill-mannered sister says.
His ill-mannered sister glared and folded her arms. They were standing in the shade, in near darkness, in fact. The tent's flaps had been veiled to let as little light in as possible. Too much might spoil the quality of the ingots before they could be smithed. Her ears burned with shame, because Alif's frantic explanations covered up the truth that the buyer had gotten too near to. The ingots were less useful. For all they were pure Nokarama metal, it would be far more proper to sell a blade, and Nawal Ashifra was sure it would be 10 times as valuable as the next cheap artifact she'd passed on display in the bazaar. But her clan couldn't forge and sell such a blade. Not anymore. Only sell the ingots. Alif's talking had gotten the interest of some other buyers. They clustered around the metal. One, a rich merchant dressed all in silks, sniffed as he eyed the metal. He knew the worth of Nokarama metal, Nawal Ashifra was sure, but he was skeptical.
I can see the value of forging a blade, but can any blacksmith manage such a feat? I am told the metal is tricky beyond belief to manage.
The question threw Alif, but it was Nawal Ashifra who interrupted. She gave the man her best smile and felt like her teeth were falling off as she gestured to the ingots.
Not so good, sirs. The metal is tricky and requires smithing only under the moonlight until quenching, but the trick of shaping the metal is easy indeed. Why not let my humble self show you?
She led the men outside, and cursing at having to waste the precious metal, took one of the wasted ingots that had been damaged by sunlight on the journey here. Nawal hammered the metal rapidly in the shade, pointing at how to hammer the metal just so to make it move correctly.
It is all about temperature, honored guests, and the striking must be precise. 6 strikes here, you see? 1, 2, 3. 3, and then another 2 here. Thus the metal moves, and care must be taken not to allow it to reduce in heat below a threshold. The forge must be hot, and no magic fire can be used at any time. Fold the metal, and then apply the powder and oil mixture before quenching the blade in light-bathed waters.
She went down the list of details and specifications, noting the dismay on the faces of her customers. Alif was grimacing at her to stop, but Nawal had memorized this routine by heart, and she knew misleading a customer would ruin the metal and throw her clan's name into the wastes. If selling the ingots as they were wouldn't do so already, that was.
So many steps.
The knowledgeable buyer shook his head. Alif hurried over to him, fawning in a disgusting manner.
We can repeat and write down the instructions to your pleasing, good sir. The metal is ready to be forged, and any high-level blacksmith can make a blade beyond all others out of it.
Nawal glared at her brother. Write down the secrets? They were already compromising all of their clan's crafts by giving away the ingots. But they had no choice. She would have rather torn off her veil and walked the bazaar naked, but their clan depended on the sales they earned from the bazaar. If they had to sell secrets to survive this year, so be it.
I will think about it. Perhaps I will return on the morrow again.
That was all they got from the well-informed buyer. The rest left without so much as that vague promise. Alif walked back to Nawal, and she glared at him.
I think he might buy if we lower the price more, sister.
What? We will barely have enough with which to eat for what we are selling already. And what was that disgusting display, you dog, you?
Nawal snapped at her brother. He glared at her.
Do not blame me for making the best of a bad situation. We must sell the ingots, and it is more profitable to sell them and earn goodwill with a merchant or other faction than to hold on to them and starve with them sitting uselessly in our homes.
Useless? A blade forged of pure Nokoroma steel is...
Nawal choked on her words. Her brother shook his head slowly and pityingly.
Useless. Since no one can forge the metal in our clan but you, dear sister. And what manner of fool or coward would use a blade forged by a woman?
That was true. Nawal knew that no self-respecting warrior in the bazaar would do so. She hung her head as Alif turned away. Her clan lived closest to the desert and made their fortune with their signature steel. However, calamity had struck them not half a year ago, and thus the metal they had meticulously refined over the course of the year was useless. She turned away, despairing, as Alif looked around. Their tent was guarded by other members of their clan, warriors armed with weapons that were mere alloys of Alrama's steel and not pure metal. Nevertheless, the weapons shone in the light such that they looked enchanted when they had yet to receive a mage's enhancements. They were still magical, though, so there was truth to the glimmer. It was all the advertisement their tent needed, in truth. Nawal's clan would have had visitors queuing up to bid on their blades any other year, and her clan's warriors would be needed to guard the tent, but not this year.
I must make arrangements. I believe I can sell the ingots for a better price than we might get if we had swords. Just hold here and do not scowl at anyone who comes in.
Alif made extravagant promises, as usual, as he hurried out of the tent. Nawal glared at his back, suspecting that he was going to get drunk and cause trouble, as usual. How could this same seed of her father's loins be so useless in him and the wrong gender in her? If he was alive, he might have died again just to see this sight. She turned away from the stacks of beautiful ingots and saw someone pushing into the tent's flaps.
Hello? Are you looking for our blades? We only have ingots for sale.
Nawal called out, too tired to pretend to be happy to see the visitor. To her surprise, she saw a pale-skinned foreigner enter the tent. His skin was far too pale for the hot sun, and he jumped at being addressed.
Ingot, sorry, I'm a bit lost. You don't sell swords? I'll be going.
He backed up towards the entrance, and Nawal's pride flared.
We used to sell swords, the finest blades you will ever see, my word on it. Don't back away, you milk-skinned fool, you! Come and see true metal, if only once in your lifetime!
Her words made the young man stop. He approached the table and gasped as he saw the Nakalrama steel.
Is that magic metal? Some kind of special metal?
Proudly, despairingly, Nawal nodded.
It is Nakalrama steel.
She looked at the young man's blank face and scowled.
Nakalrama steel? Have you never heard of it?
He hadn't. She grumbled under her breath.
Ignorant foreigners, listen well. This steel is magic, forged of the sands, refined through heat and kept from any sunlight. Such is the nature of the metal that it can endure any pressure when quenched in sun-filled waters. It will hold enchantments with ease, and the blade itself cuts through magic like water. If there was ever a blade for one who seeks to do battle against mages, this is it. You could make a blade worthy of a king out of these ingots, which we will sell for handfuls of gold.
She raised a fist and nearly struck the metal, but held back, knowing the blow would only freeze her skin to the ice-cold ingots. The young foreigner looked impressed, which warmed her heart slightly.
Wow. That's incredible. If you're selling them so cheaply, why not have someone make a sword out of...
We used to do that, you idiot, you!
She shouted at him, and the young man flinched. One of the caravan guards, Hasaif, poked his head in, and Nawal gestured to him that it was fine. He gave her a nod and resumed watching for thieves. Nawal sighed as she looked at the young man.
We had a blacksmith of renown who shaped the blades. He created less than 10 per year, but they earned enough for our clan to thrive. But he died. His heart gave out last year.
Oh, I'm sorry. But can't you get someone else to...
No! The techniques are too hard to learn overnight. It takes years of practice, and of all whom my father taught, only I learned enough to shape the metal.
The young woman laughed at the young man's confusion.
But if you can do it, can't...
Who would use a blade forged by a woman?
Who indeed? Women could be warriors, but they weren't capable of making steel. That was a fact. It was a truth among Nawal's people that women were impure. The metal grew to develop defects if they shaped it. Her father had broken with tradition because he needed a helper. But he had forbidden her from entering the forge whenever her blood flowed throughout the month. And, of course, Nawal was forbidden from shaping any blade herself. She could make armor, so long as no one knew who had done most of the forging, and goods like nails and so on, but never blades. So her father had said, while she hammered in the forge, and he claimed to have made each blade himself with her help. He had given her a chance, but he was dead, and no one else would touch a blade she made, however keen. The young man didn't seem to understand that. He was a foreigner and wrinkled his brow. Was he a mage? He was certainly no warrior of the sands, accustomed to blood and glory.
I don't know about people in your tribe, but I know someone who probably wouldn't care if you forged the blade. He just wants the best blade in the world. And if you're a...
Nakalrama.
Right. If that steel's the best, he might buy it. Why don't I ask him?
Nawal stared at the young man, and a sprig of hope entered into her heart.
You have a master?
What? No, I'm not a slave.
But he is wealthy. A man of power? How much might he spend?
He said he has at least 10,000 gold pieces, but I think he might spend more.
10,000 gold pieces? It wasn't a lot, but the thought of actually selling a blade had Nawal's mind racing. Why hadn't she thought of it before? Sell to foreigners. Surely there were some who wouldn't mind how a blade was made so long as it was sharp. Drakes, perhaps? There were rumors that there was a great dungeon filled with monsters on their continent. Perhaps if she...
Sister! Wondrous news!
A loud voice came from outside. Nawal's heart sank. She hurried out of the tent, making sure that the layers of flaps prevented any sunlight from touching the inside of the tent, and came outside with the young man to see Alif standing in front of the tent and grinning broadly. He was not alone. The rich merchant from before and a man with a whip at his side were behind him, along with a group of armed thugs. Nawal eyed them with distaste, noting their cheap iron weapons and marking the man with a whip for what he was. A slaver. Not a Vrishal, clearly. He was probably just a local slave trader who dealt with the impoverished and desperate. Nawal glared at her brother as he smiled broadly at her. He looked too happy, as if he was pulling one of his tricks on someone. They had always landed him and the people around him in deep trouble.
Alif, what is this? I have a buyer for our steel.
As do I, sister. All of it.
What? Nawal's eyes widened, and she saw the other members of her clan start. Alif had found a buyer? But she looked back at the young foreigner. How much had he compromised to sell all of their ingots? Alif rubbed his hands together, looking proud of himself.
We will earn as much as we would for a commission on blades, sister. This generous merchant, Sir Redif, will buy all the ingots from us at such a price.
At what cost?
There had to be a trick. Nawal eyed the slaver with apprehension. Alif spread his hands, looking wounded.
Sister, I made the best deal I could for the clan. I gave away only one thing to honor Redif.
Which was?
You!
Alif smiled at Nawal as the ground fell away under her. He spoke quickly as a rumble sprang up from the other clansmen.
It is the best offer, the best. We will be paid richly, and you, dear sister, will be sent to show any blacksmiths how to forge Nokoroma metal. You will be able to continue helping around the forge and find a husband, if Honored Redif is generous. It is for the clan, sister.
Nawal just stared. Slavers? Her father had banned slaves from the clan 2 decades ago, before she had been born. Metal forged with the weight of shackles was as impure as that of metal made with dishonest deeds or blood, or so he had said. She stared at her brother. Her brother.
You cannot sell me, Alif!
A flash passed across Alif's eyes, one of his dark moods nearly escaping.
I can and will. I am our representative, and I speak for our family and clan with our father's death.
You are not worthy of licking his boots, you spineless worm!
How dare you!
He raised his hand, and Nawal gripped her knife's handle, making Alif hesitate. The merchant interrupted impatiently.
Enough! This isn't a debate. I have papers proving my ownership of both the Nokoroma metal and Nawal Shifra Tanusin.
He brandished a sealed parchment, signed in blood. It was a binding contract. Nawal looked at it and felt her stomach drop. He'd actually signed it, without asking, without thought. Alif smiled victoriously as the other Tanusin clansmen muttered curses.
Sister, is it really too much to ask? You will be well-treated. Privileged, even. Our father was mad for letting you hold a hammer, but I have given you the same honor. Do not make this harder than you have to.
No struggles, girl. I've broken more new slaves than I care to remember.
The slaver grinned as he unslung his whip, and his thugs drew their weapons. Nawal walked slowly over to Elif. He smiled at her.
Ah, sister, do you see reason?
Goodbye, brother.
Nawal stared into her brother's eyes. He tried to look remorseful, but just looked insincere. He bent to embrace her, and she drew her dagger and plunged it into his chest. Elif gasped and his eyes went wide. There was a shout from behind him, but too late. Nawal's voice was low as she felt blood rush over her blade.
I renounce you. I renounce you. I renounce you.
She whispered it into Elif's ears as he choked and then twisted the dagger. He gasped and clutched at her shoulder. Then he fell backwards. The merchants and slave traders stared at Elif in shock and then backed up as Nawal retrieved her dagger from her brother's body.
There will be no sale, and I am no slave. Honored buyers, I regret to tell you my brother erred in selling me and my clan's wealth.
Nawal smiled very politely at the pale-faced merchant. The man gaped at her and then colored with outrage.
Insolent woman! You may have killed Elif, but the contract...
He flinched as Nawal swung her dagger and spattered the contract and the merchant with blood. She cleaned her dagger with a handkerchief as she spoke calmly.
I have renounced him 3 times. He is dead to my clan and I, and no longer of our blood. Any contract he signs is dust.
Her clansmen appeared behind her, and Nawal was relieved to feel his safe's presence at her back. The slaver eyed her and cracked his whip.
Is that so? Well, I have a contract, and I say we enforce it right now. There's always room in my train for more slaves, and breaking a contract is a crime.
He raised his whip to strike at Nawal, and there was a flash of light. Nawal blinked as the young foreigner blinded the slaver and his thugs, making them hesitate. She felt his safe shift and readied herself for a bloody battle. But in the moment the light had flashed, someone had appeared next to the slaver.
I wouldn't start a fight.
A tall woman with blue hair and starry eyes, a vision of perfection, stood next to the merchant and the slaver. She wore brown scale armor made of a metal that Nawal had never seen before, and held a great sword in one hand. The woman smiled slightly as she held the great sword underneath the slaver's throat. He gulped and cut himself.
I'm a slaver.
With a bad contract. You heard her.
The woman nodded at Nawal. The merchant, pale-faced, backed up a step.
Harming a merchant in the bazaar.
Who said anything about harming? I am simply defending a shopkeeper from being illegally made into a slave. If you want to try and enforce your contract, I'll defend her and myself, starting with your head.
Her voice was loud enough for the other people watching to hear. Nawal admired her poise. This foreigner woman had the respect of the bazaar and could slice apart the slaver and his thugs without repercussion if they called her bluff, and the merchant knew it. He backed up, and the slaver, realizing the same, fled. The thugs he'd hired melted away as the young man turned. She slapped a hand over his mouth, and he staggered. She stared at him, and his eyes widened.
Gabrielle! I thought you'd lost me.
I didn't lose you. You wandered off, and I was waiting for you to find me. But you found something interesting, so I decided to wait.
Gabrielle, the mysterious woman, turned to Nawal. She had a slight smile on her face.
So you're a Tanusan blacksmith? You, a woman?
She knew about Clan Tanusan? Nawal straightened, pride in her voice.
I am. Though I may be a woman, I am the only successor to my father's craft, master that he was. I can forge true blades of Nakaroma steel, woman-touched though they may be.
Her announcement drew a murmur from the crowd, a disapproving one, but Nawal only had eyes for Gabrielle and the young man. They looked at each other, and the young foreigner spoke.
I think our, master wouldn't mind that, cause... Gabrielle, what do you think?
I think he would accept such a blade gladly, no matter what hands touched it.
Gabrielle looked thoughtfully at Nawal.
Do you truly claim to have your father's skill?
Nawal drew herself up, her eyes flashing. She raised her voice as she stood with her brother's dead body lying at her feet. She would grieve for who he was and who he had been later, but this was pride and steel. It was the pride of her clan.
Lead me to your master, foreign warrior. Pay my cost, and I will forge your master a blade sharper and finer than any he has laid eyes on in his life. My oath on it. I swear it on the body of the man who was my brother. Cursed be his name.
She pointed at her brother with her dagger, and the young man flinched, but Gabrielle just smiled wider.
Good. In that case, come with me.
She turned and began to stride through the bazaar. That was a bit too sudden, even for Nawal. She hesitated as the young man turned.
This way. Sorry, I never got your name.
I am Noelle Shifra Tanusen, a blacksmith. Who are you?
She stared at the young man, all pale skin and awkwardness. But he had surprised the slaver with magic, and he clearly knew this Gabrielle. Who was his master? The young man smiled at her, and Nawal drew her veil further over her face in embarrassment.
Me? I'm Trey.
Trey had had weird days, but it felt like they all paled in comparison to an ordinary day around Floss. Even when he wasn't here, things got weird. He now stood in a bazaar with Nawal, a blacksmith wearing a veil. She seemed calm, despite having stabbed her brother through the heart moments ago. Ghazi was equally calm as she stood at ease, sheathing her blade on her back. She didn't seem bothered by the death either.
It was her clan's politics. Her brother would have died had she gone with the slaver. His people would have beaten him to death the instant they were alone.
Oh, but Nawal...
Ghazi smiled. Her illusionary face stayed the same, but Trey knew one of her eyes was fixed on Nawal as the dark-skinned young woman began shouting at the rest of her clan standing behind her.
Well done in finding her. I've heard of Clan Tanusen before. They can outsmith a dwarf. Most dwarves, at any rate. If this young woman can truly smith Nakalrama steel, she must be at least level 30, probably higher.
What? Huh?
Trey stared at Nawal as she shouted animatedly at her fellow tribespeople, cursing them and exhorting them to clean up the body and keep the light out of the tent at all costs. He turned to Ghazi, embarrassed.
I didn't do much. I just wandered in by accident, and when I heard how good the blades were, I thought of his you know who.
Indeed. And I thought the same thing, and let you enter the tent.
Ghazi smiled as Nawal strode over to them. She looked far more cheerful, despite having just lost a brother.
Lead on then, Trey and Gabrielle. Take me to your master, and I will see what blade he wants. I will offer him a discount he does not deserve. More, if he will buy all the metal we possess. Assuming he has coin, of course.
He has that, and he will buy every blade you can forge.
Ghazi assured Nawal as she led them through the bazaar. Trey couldn't help but notice that they were being followed by some of Nawal's clan members, probably for her protection, although Trey didn't think he'd stand a chance. She'd moved very quick with that knife of hers.
So where is he? Have you a camp? We must talk details, and I must see your coin.
Nawal was impatient. Ghazi just smiled. She looked amused for some reason, and Trey began dreading why. He is just up ahead, at that tent. It was a familiar tent, the very same one they'd passed by upon first entering the bazaar. It was the one with the scrying orbs, and as Trey saw the huge crowd gathered around it, he heard Floss's voice. He was shouting loudly, standing in the middle of the bazaar, and his illusion was gone. Floss, the king of destruction, stood in front of a mage from Parasol Stroll who was holding a scrying orb up at him. He was speaking into it, his voice booming, the people around him looking awestruck or terrified as the Serpent Hunters and Parasol Stroll formed a protective wall around him. Mars stood behind the King of Destruction as he spoke into the scrying orb, addressing an unseen audience. The entire world.
I am the King of Destruction! I have returned! If there is any nation that seeks my end, come, send your armies to me, but I will not make war on any nation that treats my people and my kingdom as friend. Let any who crave glory flock to my banner, and any foe of mine quake behind your walls. I am Floss of Rhyme, and I have awoken!
Trey covered his face. He wished he was dreaming. He turned and saw no wall, staring at Floss, her face suddenly dead white. He could hear the voices.
The King of Destruction, here.
Impossible.
Amnesty. He wants adventurers and warriors to join him.
He won't declare war?
Floss continued, his voice a roar.
The Empire of Sands is my foe. I will slay the Emperor of Sands myself. As for Wistrom, send Ameris to me. Return to me, my mage, or I will sail upon your walls and break your academy into dust. I say again, I will make war on no nation that does not attack my people, but the blood of Dravish stains the Empire of Sands, and I will return the favor 100,000 times over.
He went on, shouting into the orb, his image captured, his words projected across 1,000 scrying orbs in 1,000 spots across the world. Ghazi turned to Nawal and smiled.
That is our master.
Him? You mean...
The young woman had lost her self-assurance. She stared at Floss as if he were, well, Floss, the King of Destruction. Trey saw her pale as she recalled her bold claims of a moment ago. Ghazi just smiled wickedly.
So, a blade worthy of a king, and one my lord has never seen before. Your oath on it.
She looked at Nawal, and the young woman glanced at Trey, and then at the King of Destruction. She fainted. Trey caught her just in time and looked up to see Floss, the King of Destruction, grinning at him out of 1,000 scrying orbs. He gestured, and the world followed his every word. In a bazaar, standing in front of a dusty tent filled with scrying orbs, Floss sent the pillars of the world quaking and laughed as nations and kings scrambled to catch up. Somehow, Trey had expected nothing less.